you very much, and welcome to the program in which one good word not only deserves, but usually gets another in return. And today, the players who will bandy our words are Dilys Powell, Frank Muir, P.D. James, and Dennis Norton. And we start with an anatomical round, questions that all have to do with nasal organs, or as we doctors call them, noses. Frank, who was the owner of the nose which was of vast proportions and painted red and tied with cords to the back of his head?
Did it have a lantern inside it?
Right. He's an author that Dennis and I have publicly admitted we don't care for a great deal.
The Bible. I'm sorry you've had to help me so much, but I have a feeling it's Lear.
The ding your dong.
And it's the dong.
Yes.
It's the dong, the dong. The what? Dong with the luminous nose.
2 marks.
It's the lantern.
And it does have a lantern, does it? I mean, I like to be
fenced
educated.
About with a bandage stout to prevent the wind from blowing it out.
Sounds very Learish. Phyllis, what's believed to be the origin of the phrase nosy Parker?
Well, the only Parker in history I know anything about at all, I don't know much about him, was the first archbishop in Elizabeth I's reign. He was Parker. And he's the one who had to be very carefully consecrated, didn't he? Because if the consecration wasn't valid, the poor old Church of England hasn't got any apostolic succession. Well, I didn't think he was particularly nosy. I think the Queen had an awful lot of trouble with him, but I thought that was to do with his sermons.
Well, I wouldn't qualify what you're saying to it, because you got the answer that's written down in front of me here on the full authority of Peter Hall. 2 marks to Philip. Oh,
we don't know why he was called nosy.
Well, it says here, Matthew Parker, Archbishop of Canterbury, whose overzealous probing of religious ceremonial alienated both the Catholics and the Puritans. So I suppose it was the overzealous probing with his nose. Anyway, 2 marks.
You're giving me two. Oh, that's kind.
Dilys, Pascal in his Pensée made a profound statement about a certain nose. Can you quote it?
I don't think I can quote it. I think I know who it was.
Well, in English, give us an English loose translation.
He said that if Cleopatra's nose had been shorter, I think not longer, shorter, it would have changed the history of the world or the progress of the human race or whatever.
Well, 2 marks to you. And a minus mark to the woman in the audience who suggested you were wrong. Because the quotation, loosely translated, is, if the nose of Cleopatra had been shorter, the whole face of the earth would have been changed. Well done, Dilys. Dennis, for what nasal reason was Captain FitzHugh of HMS Beagle dubious about signing on Charles Darwin as the ship's naturalist?
Was it sort of one of those hook noses that might have been caught up in the ship's hammock?
2 marks today. I mean, you get the 2 marks because it's much more interesting than the boring answer I've got written down here. Because according to Peter Moore, our word setter, the captain who is a student of physiognomy believed that Darwin's snub nose was a sign of lack of energy and determination.
Oh, rubbish.
Rubbish, yes. Well, before we go on to round two, here, Frank and Dennis, are the quotations you were given for the last round. And Frank's is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and Dennis's is Friends, Romans, Countrymen. Meanwhile, we go on to one of those rounds that form the vertebrae of this programme, Origins and Derivations, and they always mean trouble for the chairman. Frank, origin of the phrase to get one's goat.
It's an American expression, I think. I'm sure.
It is, yes.
Goat's always associated with the devil, isn't it? Remember, tradition had it that nobody had ever looked at a goat for 24 hours, because once each day, each goat sneaks off and has its beard combed by the devil. So to get one's goat means to provoke one into being beastly and having a little of the devil into them. I rest my case.
I think, I mean, you
better settle for 1.5 marks for any sort of debate.
No, 2 marks. Two marks. Again, simply on the grounds, it's much more interesting. And I don't believe the derivation that I've been given, but which is, for what it's worth, it was because the derivation I've given is not American. It is, or used to be, it says, standard practice for racehorse owners to stable a goat with their thoroughbred to act as a four-legged sedative. Thus, to steal the goat was a means of unsettling its highly strung stable companion.
I think it is true, isn't
it? Is it?
Well, they certainly, you always have a sheep or a goat.
Ah, that's true, but getting one's goat was going stealing the racehorse's goat.
So, have a mark and a half, Michael.
I take a mark and a half. I'm in with a chance this week. I've got a mark and a half. Phyllis, the origin of to canter. Why does a horse canter when it sort of gallops slowly, I suppose?
Has it got anything to do with place, journeys?
Yes.
It has. Oh, it's got something to do with place. It's got to Canterbury, hasn't it? That's easy.
Yes.
Now the rest of it. Is it the pace at which I'm going to have two chances here? Either the pilgrims went to Canterbury from London, or else the mail coach cantered from the east end of London to Canterbury.
I think the mail coach would have been a bit slower to canter when it was more of a gallop.
Yes, but then I thought it was a bit fast for the pilgrims, because I think they ambled along at sort of walking pace.
Yes, well, I suppose in between stories they cantered and then ambled. Anyway, that is the origin, and that is 2 marks of Phyllis. Well done.
Isn't it also Latin for the Archbishop of Canterbury?
Cantua.
Yes. That's how he signs his... Dillis, the origin of a bean feast.
A bean feast?
Yes, a sort of high-fibre meal. A bean feast.
I think it goes back to days when people didn't get many beans and liked them. Mm. I don't think about it. Never heard such an idea. Is there an origin?
It also has a specific meaning, which might help you. And the specific meaning
you
is...
You say full of beans. Full of beans, which means very, very jolly and cheerful. So I suppose a bean feast... Mm. Was a jolly feast.
It used to be always a feast that was given by an employer for his employees.
printers, not printers.
No. It's said not because they were fed only beans, but because of the goose that they got from the bean-shaped mark on its beak.
Oh, nonsense.
don't say nonsense too loudly, because you've got one mark and you might lose it.
Oh, well.
Anyway, a mark to Dillis. Dennis, origin of a sundae is as in an ice cream sundae with an AE on the end.
You don't like Edward Lear. Do you like H.L. Mencken?
Hmm.
So do I. And there was a period in my life when I adored the writings of H.L. Mencken. He wrote a book called The American Language, in which, as I recall, he devoted pages to the origin of Sunday. Not one page, but literally pages to this one word. Now, I can't remember the...
just one line will do.
Yeah, well, it started, as I recall, in a city called Twin something or other. It was either Twin Rivers or Twin City or something like that, where for the first time, they put some kind of syrup, I think it was chocolate syrup, over the ice cream, and it tasted so special, and it looked so elegant, that this druggist, or whatever they call them, soda jerk, he charged, I can't remember how much, but Mencken does specify how much extra he charged for it, and served it only on Sunday, so as to show what a luxury, what an elegant luxury it was.
That'll do. Sunday, Dennis got his mark. Now, next round, our word setter, Peter Moore, has once again been rummaging through Russell Ashe and Brian Lake's collection of odd book titles. And today's haul includes Teach Yourself Alcoholism, The Little I Saw of Cuba, and The Art of Faking Exhibition Poultry. Well, team, how important do you think titles are? As a reader or as a writer, have you, for instance, been misled by a title or thought of a title for which you couldn't come up with a book? Frank, thoughts about titles?
Dennis and I, once, years ago, we were working on Taking Over Here, we're making a small but exquisite collection of unriveting titles. And one was The Romance of Soil. But my favourite one, which has extremely sinister undertones, was Hindustani Self-Taught by the Natural Method.
Phyllis.
I remember when I was quite young being told by a friend that I really must read Appointment in Samara, mm-hmm. and finding that this was extremely misleading because I thought it was going to be a travel book about the Middle East, not about prohibition, small-town prohibition in America, and a very fine novel too. I think some are just dull. And Anthony Trollope's Can You Forgive Her, I think, is an awful title.
Dillis.
Well, led by the cinema, I did sometimes think it'd be nice to write a book called I'm a Middle-Aged Werewolf. But I didn't write it. I was once, I remember, very much approached for calling a book quite seriously by a title which other people thought was a novel. It wasn't. It was a very serious book, very solemn indeed. It was called An Affair of the Heart. And somebody wrote to me angrily and said, I bought this damn book. I thought it was a novel, and it wasn't.
Dennis.
Well,
titles.
In a collection of memoirs about Virginia Woolf, somebody talks about the Bloomsbury parties, where a lady novelist, a lady romantic novelist of that time called Berta Ruck, always used to sing a song called Never Allow a Sailor an Inch Above Your Knee. And I've scoured the BBC Music Library and second-hand bookshop. If anybody's got it, I'd be most glad.
I think we'll give you all 1,000 marks each to even up on that. Next round, called Badgetisms, some thumbnail sketches of the famous by Walter Badgett, the 19th century journalist. Frank, she was one of the smallest people ever set in a great place, he wrote of her.
Nicely, kind lady. Mm. Queen Anne, very dead.
Two marks. Phyllis. One specially for you. He was a detective. He was a detective in a dean's wig.
Well, he must have been Dean Swift, was he?
Too much.
I wouldn't have known it except for the dean's wig.
Too much. Got the murderer in one. Dillis. He was not a common man, but a common man might have been cut out of him.
A prime minister?
Prime minister. Foreign secretary 3 times.
Oh, Palmerston.
Palmerston. 2 marks to do it. It was a splendid, that, isn't it? A common man cut out of him.
Lovely remark.
Dennis. Throughout the greater part of his life, he was a kind of consecrated obstruction.
I once quoted this in a speech referring to the Independent Broadcasting Authority. I said it was Macaulay. I didn't get any... Nobody put their hands up and said, oh, no, you're wrong. It's a light entertainment department, mind you. it was George the Third.
George the Third. Yeah. 2 marks to Dennis. And now we come to the last round, and Frank and Dennis's quotations. And Frank's is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
I've been through a very emotional day today. The whole thing has been most fraught indeed, and I hope you'll excuse me if, when I account this rather difficult story, if I could have hush in all parts of the house throughout. I realized I was ill about mid-morning today when I had this sort of prickly feeling on my chest and back, and it's got more painful. If I rubbed it, it was really quite painful. And there were about four or five places in front and three or four at the back. And my wife was away for the day, fortunately, so that I could suffer in silence. And I really think I knew that I had something really rather dangerous here. So I consulted the home doctor book, which is my Bible. And it said, if you feel you are unwell rather than well, first take your temperature. Make sure it is normal and not abnormal. So I went to the bathroom and got out the thermometer from its tube and did as nurses do. I held one end between finger and thumb, raised my little finger, and gave it a brisk shake. Bing dong dong. And I was on my hands and knees. Ricocheted from the ceiling, past the wall, and ended up under the towel rail. Broken. Now, I had to take my temperature. The only other thermometer I could find in the house was in the kitchen, was a kitchen thermometer, which is in fact very wide. Maybe you put into simmering pans. But I stretched my lips very well. Got the thermometer into my mouth and I couldn't read it. And I went to the mirror, but then I could read it, but the words were backwards. And I had to get a mirror out of my wife's second handbag in order to correct the upside. It was a torturous process, but it was and also very alarming when I did read it, because I was midway, my temperature was midway between icing sugar and blancmange. Which is clearly not good news at all. Then the book said, check your weight from the diagram at the back and see it is equal to the average weight you should be as against your height. And it said, NB, it is pointless weighing yourself with your clothes on. You must weigh yourself undressed. Well, that was no particular problem. It got to be a problem, actually, because the chemist shop was quite busy. It was one of those weighing machines with arms and weights and things you had to claim. It took rather a long time. And I thought they said for the police, but happily it was just the photographer from the Sims and Egan News. But while I was undressed, I suddenly saw these awful marks on my chest. They were sort of reddish sort of lumps, and I knew what I had, and it was really a frightful moment. So I hastened my clothes on, rushed across the road, you know Egham High Street, but across the road, through the little hole, across the car park, and across the other little road, and into the doctor's surgery. And I said to Miss on reception, please don't put me amongst the others. I think this is awfully difficult. It's a contagious disease. And she hurried me through to the doctor, and he said, take your shirt off. And she came in, Miss on reception came in with my medical file, and I said, I'm afraid, Doctor, you'd better alert the county medical authorities, if not the ministry, because I might be holding an outbreak of contagious frog pock. So he looked at the marks on my chest and then said, give me your shirt, and looked at the shirt, and he looked at the nurse and showed her the shirt, and he went, oh my goodness. And Miss on reception said, wait till I tell the patients in the waiting room, this will give them a good laugh, they certainly need. I said, he said it's not malignant frogquack. Was this a new shirt you put on this morning? And I said, yes, I took it out of its cellophane and unbuttoned it and put it on. And he said, next time, take the pins out. I said, Doctor and Miss on reception, I may not have contagious frog pock, It might be just pins from my shirt, which of course is contagious. But I do resent the manner in which I've been treated. I said, I came in here fully expecting you as the medical team to give me professional sympathy and comfort. Instead of that, what have I had? Dr. Chuckle and Mr. Ride. Oh.
Didn't spot that one, even though it's medical. Dennis, friends, Romans, countrymen.
You know, a man gets to thinking when he's stuck up in the top of a yew tree in his garden, waiting for the fire brigade to come and get him down. That's the reason I'd been obliged to get them to rescue me, but that was because there was no one else at home at the time, so I had to attract the attention of the Italian gentleman who'd recently moved next door. Even so, I'd been shouting, help, help, for about an hour before I heard him answer, what's your problem? I yelled back, I'm stuck up a yew tree. He said, scusi. I screamed, up a yew. I wasn't to know he had such a command of colloquial English. So that was why he refused to come to my aid personally, though he did finally consent to telephone the local fire brigade. And, of course, the first thing that they asked once they'd returned me to the brown, brown grass of home was, how did you get yourself up there in the first place? But I must admit, that wasn't an easy question to answer. How do you explain to a gentleman wearing a brass helmet that the reason you suddenly found yourself among the topmost branches of an elderly tree was because a lifelong friend had recently fallen for a lady half his age and almost twice his weight? Now, don't get me wrong. If Ernest was seeking an emotional anchorage for his autumnal years, who was I to question his yearning for a few more enchanted evenings? Nor was it the fact that he stands no more than 5'6" with his umbrella up, while she had the kind of bodily configuration that would make Rambo look effeminate. No, what was nagging at me was the difference in their temperaments. Now, now he's always been a confirmed bachelor, and you know what they're like, they're neat, tidy, punctilious. He's not only the one person I've ever met who puts shoe trees in his carpet slippers. He actually does keep gloves in his car's glove compartment. Absolutely invincibly correct. I can't think of anyone else who always eats crisps with a knife and fork. On the other hand, this lady he lost his heart to. Well, I can only give you my first impression that afternoon he took me round to her flat for tea. Now, I'm not implying that she ought to have dressed up for the occasion. No, I don't mean. But honestly, she could at least have taken off her shower cap. And while I've never been one to go around looking for things to criticize, there are certain details you can't help but notice. This is, for example, when we followed her into the front room, the way she had her dress tucked into the back of her tights. It was tiny things like that, you know. Plus other significant little indications. Her habit of picking her teeth with a book match cover. The fact that her charm bracelet had a bottle opener on it. or the way that throughout that somewhat scanty meal, she sat painting her toenails. Instead, it's the first time I've seen any lady do that by dipping them in the varnish. Those were the sort of clues that led me to fear that my dear old friend had got himself involved in what the Americans call a no-win situation. And it was that thought that filled my mind that summer evening when I got back home, wandered into the garden, and moodily threw myself on a garden bed that I happened to find out there. Except it wasn't a garden bed. It was a trampoline my kids had bought. So perhaps you can now understand how it was that I got myself treed, sent winging up into the top of the old yew. I must say, the explanation when I gave it made a great impression on those firemen. One of them even said to me, in all my years at this work, I've never before realized that a man can end up in a treetop simply from brooding about an old mate's love affair. Oh, come, I said. Don't you recall Mark Antony's famous observation? Friends romance can tree man.
Thank you, Dennis. Our panel of senior wranglers has totted up the score and declare that our winners today are P.D. James and Dennis Norton. And indeed, today they qualify for one of our star prizes, the trip of a lifetime round the world, travelling all the way on supersonic radio waves. Indeed, we've all been invited to leap aboard the airwaves, and as our program whizzes towards the horizon, I just have time to say goodbye.